like fiend with diesel in his needle. Queensbridge leader, no equal. I come from the will of Ezekiel to pop $1,000 bottles of Scott, smoke pot, and heal a people. Any rebuttal to what I utter, get box cut it. Count them any bad honeys. I slut, it's a high number. Name a nigga under the same sky that I'm under. Who gets money remain fly? Yeah, I wonder.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I am the editor in chief of Cracked, the former poor man's version of Mad Magazine, present day rich man's version of BuzzFeed. On today's podcast, I'm talking to Jason Pargin, aka David Wong, best-selling author of John Dies at the End, and its sequel, This Book is Full of Spiders, subtitle, Seriously, Dude, Don't Touch It. And we're talking about weird ways movies affect reality. I spent the last couple of years working on our new book, The D-Text Book, which is a gorgeously illustrated full-color textbook now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. In case you haven't purchased a copy yet, unlike all of your most sexually desirable peers, the D-Text Book is sort of our mission to undo the damage of your formal education. I'll give you a quick example of what that means. I remember a poster on one of my classroom walls when I was a kid, featuring an ostrich sticking its head in the sand. I think it was probably like a motivational poster with some saying about the value of pulling one's head out of their own ass. I may not have that wording exactly right, but the message was clear. Hey, look at this stupid asshole. We also learned lemmings jump off cliffs, bulls charge at the color red. But it turns out none of those things are true. So lemmings don't jump off cliffs, bulls don't charge the color red, and ostriches do not stick their head in the sand when frightened. They peck at the sand to pick up pebbles that aid them in digestion, but they probably avoid doing that when scared, seeing as how they are 300-pound birds that can run 60 miles per hour for a half hour straight. And if they got caught by whatever was scaring them, they could bend their knees backwards and disembowel whatever it was that was chasing them with 2,000 pounds of razor-clawed force. And this is what we found over and over again while researching our book. And in most cases, reality is way more interesting than the version based on the lies they told us. And one of the things that kept surprising me over and over again is how much that image of reality is based on movies. And what's strange, though, is that the version of reality in movies is also oftentimes way more boring than the truth. Which is weird, right? I mean, it's understandable that teachers and textbooks would make everything seem more boring than reality because it's easier for them to manage a classroom full of children who are on the verge of falling asleep than a classroom full of children who are vibrating because they can't fucking believe how cool ostriches are. But movies are supposed to entertain us, so why would they lie to make reality seem boring? That is what Jason and I are about to discuss right now. Are dripping the ways of Carlito, blaze, torpedo cigars, drop rolls, hoes, drop clothes, Louis the 13th, freaks, women nice size, I ride like cautious, thick, brown, and gorgeous, it ain't my fault, semi-automatic weapons, I brought the world crazy, I'm rich and I'm girl crazy. Dick them, convince them all to praise me, the ideology is confusion, I lose them, fallace me. All right, we're talking to executive editor Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong. Hi, Jason.
Hello. For those of you not familiar with Cracked, Jack is my boss. If you've seen the show Homeland, Jack would be Mandy Patinkin's character, the director of the CIA, and then I would be like the Brody, who it appears he's on the side of the other guy of Saul, but secretly is building a suicide vest to blow up everyone and just trying to gain their trust one day at a time.
Which is pretty reassuring since you're actually coming out to the offices pretty soon. So today we're talking about ways that movies and popular culture can kind of bleed into reality. And it's something that I think people have a general sense happens, right? Like you see someone wearing a particularly cool pair of shorts in a movie. That's not probably a thing that's ever happened. The claims that, you know, violence is caused by things that happen in movies, generally I associate that with Wolf Blitzer and, you know, Fox News and people like that. I don't really lend it much credence that there are these harmful trends that are started by movies. But when you actually sit down and look at it, we've found that there are more subtle ways, less obvious ways in which movies influence reality.
To give an example, like if you watched a movie that had some outlandish premise, let's say the movie was about an architect who in the first act he finds out his house is haunted. Okay, you're watching that, you know that it's a fictional movie, you know there's no such thing as ghosts or whatever, and you know that when the demon comes out of his house, that's all fiction, that's all fantasy. But the scenes where he's being an architect, you subconsciously assume that that is generally real. Like if it had a scene early on where he's at the office doing architect stuff, it gets implanted in your brain that, oh yeah, that seems about right. And there are many, 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 many things that you only know about the world that you've only seen in a movie. And I'm talking broad things. Like if you live in the suburbs or growing up in the suburbs, everything you know about life in the inner city or about gang life or the life of drug dealers, you know it from cop shows or you know it from movies about that subject. And so a movie like Training Day, where Denzel Washington obviously plays this very flamboyant loose cannon cop with two guns and all this stuff, like you know some of that is not real. When the good guy cop tells him, hey, this is against the rules, what you're doing, you actually are still trusting another character written by a movie writer to tell you what the actual procedures are. And I think there's lots of little things that have wormed their way into the consciousness that in reality is just something that was farted out by just a screenwriter. They had no particular expertise on the subject. But it's still things that are almost universally believed in a lot of cases.
Yeah, when you talk about locations that are kind of imprinted in our imagination by what we've seen in movies, whenever I hear about a story happening in Russia, Moscow, in my imagination, has never not been covered in snow. And actually, half the year, it's summery and beautiful. Moscow, in particular, is somewhat cold. But it's not 6 months out of the year when you go visit Moscow. There aren't people wearing giant furry things on top of their head. That's just something that was invented as movie shorthand, right?
Yeah, and like you said, it's a sort of shorthand. Even if either of us sat down now to write a story, we had a scene, we were going to write some globetrotting spy movie, and they stop in Moscow. Either one of us writes that scene, it's going to be a gray, overcast day, and they're going to be wearing winter jackets. Well, where did we get that from? So we got it from other movies, and somebody else got it from another movie, and then somebody else got that. It's the same thing with people writing cop shows, same thing with people writing medical dramas. It's written by people who are basing their knowledge of those things on other movies they've seen. So because every movie shows it being snowy in Moscow, or every movie shows Australia being desert, that's what you fall back on, because that's the mental picture that's formed. But the original mental picture of that, God knows where it originated.
And you find this with history, obviously. For instance, every single depiction of ancient Greece in the popular imagination has been khaki and white colored. You never see any colors anywhere. And that was just something everyone kind of agreed on. But scientists just found by studying statues from ancient Greece that they were all brightly colored.
Yeah, because they painted the statues originally, but the paint long faded, just leaving blank, and you think that's just a stylistic choice. Well, no, they used to have painted the pupils on there, but the paint just faded.
Right. So we've covered a bunch of these things where the real world looks totally different than the stuff that we see in the movies. But there's been a few that I've found particularly surprising that have totally changed the way that I think of things. The one that I remember thinking, oh, my misconception from a movie would have killed me there, is with guns. I'm someone who's only been in a handful of gun battles in my life, so I don't have a ton of experience. Based on a lifetime of watching action movies, my understanding of what I should do if I or someone around me drops a gun is I should do my best to grab that gun, because when it hits the ground, it's going to go off. And that seems like the most dangerous thing that can happen. It hits the ground and fires in a random direction. And they've been designing guns to not go off when they hit the ground for 20, 30 years. And in fact, people who are trained and experienced in handling guns tell you that the one thing you should never, ever ever try and do is catch a fallen gun, because that's how you shoot yourself. But you never see that happen in movies. You never see someone trying to grab a gun and shooting themselves. You only see the gun fall out of their hands, hit the ground, and then fire. So it's the exact wrong message to send. And I think it happens because it's not cool to see either the good guy or the bad guy grab the gun and shoot themselves accidentally. It leaves some gray area of causation. It's a better story. It makes for a better scene if guns do go off when they hit the ground.
Yeah, and I think, for instance, when you're writing something, anything that has to do with the limitations of the technology, such as how many bullets are in the gun, you only include that ever as a plot point. If you see a character in a gunfight run out of bullets, it is absolutely not because the writer or the editor or the director counted, oh, yeah, that's 15 shots. He's got a Glock 19. There'd be only 15 because we didn't see him chamber a round, so there'd be only 15 rounds in there. That's never, ever, ever why you see them run out of bullets. It's always because this moment, for the maximum amount of drama, needs him to be in a position of weakness, so we need him to lose his gun, so we'll have it run out of bullets. And that's the same thing with anything that shows the limits of a technology, from, I don't know, a car overheating. It's never based on the actual knowledge of how that machine works. It's always based on what makes the scene the most exciting. And so that's why we imagine machine guns just shooting forever, when in reality, a magazine-fed gun is going to empty its clip in 2 seconds. You hold it down, one, two, it's empty, at full auto. This is why machine guns are largely useless. But in a movie, you know, they'll shoot forever for however long it takes to keep the scene exciting. So unless it's a device that you've used, and most people don't use guns in their day-to-day, it's impossible to learn anything about it. And the screenwriter has no reason whatsoever to give you an accurate picture of that. They're not making a documentary. So this is why most people have, like you said, have no idea how guns actually work or whatever. There's no reason for the movie to educate you on those things.
Right. It doesn't make it any more entertaining. It just adds additional information and boring. Who cares, right? Some other examples, I guess a lot of people bought owls as pets, assuming that they were just going to be the easily tameable creatures that they were in the wizarding world of Harry Potter. And this left a number of English suburbs with plagues of abandoned owls that they had to deal with. And in America, the popularity of the CSI franchise has made it basically impossible for prosecutors to get a conviction without some manner of DNA evidence, forensic evidence. That people always expect there to be something that you can see under a black light. The actor Robert Blake, there were dozens of people who witnessed him shoot his wife in a restaurant. There's two guys who he tried to hire to shoot his wife, and he got off because his defense attorney just kept being like, well, but there's no DNA evidence. Wouldn't there be something that showed that he had done this with 99% certainty, like it happens in the David Caruso shows? And that worked. I think it's been working a lot recently.
Yeah, and because of the way that those shows are presented, in a movie when a scientist character says something, we do tend to assume the thing that guy said is true. It doesn't matter if the movie is about they're having to build a spaceship to go fight a giant space monster. If the scientist explains something about the physics of building the ship, that just comes off as real. And so like the movie Jaws, we knew that in real life sharks probably don't bite through your boat, or they don't get to be that big or whatever. But when the scientist character is like, look, this thing is perfectly evolved eating machine, and all it does is eat people, and it sees people as a buffet. In the movie, that guy knew his stuff. He was the shark expert. And so when he said that, that part seemed true. The scientific background sounds accurate. So in one of those cop shows, the premise of the show is they've always got some sort of microscopic evidence that their big crime laser can detect. And there's no such thing as a CSI episode where in the first act, before the first commercial break, they're like, ah, no, the murder weapon was left out in the rain too long. There's nothing to recover on here. And then they just go out to a restaurant for the rest of the episode, and somebody else, the other cops have to go get a witness or something. That didn't happen. The premise of the show is they find the evidence. So it's very easy, even though you know that every single plot line, every single case character on the show is fiction, still, when the scientist says, well, when a person grabs a knife, they leave skin cells, it's very easy to think, well, this part is true. This is based on actual science. So if they find DNA, microscopic evidence, or fibers 100% of the time, it's just automatic. Well, in a real crime, it should be there. And now in the jury instruction videos, when you actually do jury duty, they have to tell you this. They now have to explain the differences. I think my favorite example from that, because this is something that everyone should actually know, but is the whole one phone call. I get one phone call if I'm arrested. That's on like every movie where the hero gets arrested or whatever, telling the cops, I want my one phone call. That never has been the rule ever. I don't know where it came from. It was something that one single movie needed it as a plot point. I'm sure at some point in the past where the character only had one call he could make and then who he called was like an important point. And then every other screenwriter just adopted it as right up through the Matrix. Neo's like, I want my phone call. I want my one single phone call.
And isn't it also the idea that if they don't read you your Miranda rights, you get to go free? That feels like it's in the same. I mean, that can't be true, right? Reducing criminal justice to like having a password or something.
Yeah. No, it's if they're going to interrogate you. And the phone thing, if somebody's wondering, well, what is the rule on the phone? The rule is you have to be able to contact an attorney, obviously. They may take away your phone privileges if you're misbehaving, but otherwise, if you got called somebody to come pick you up or whatever, or somebody to post bond, they want you to be able to do that. So the idea, like, you call and then you get a busy signal, like, oh, I've lost my one phone call, I'm just stuck here. Mentally, you know that would be a ludicrous rule to have. It would make life harder on everyone. Yet you just saw at some point that entered into the consciousness. The funniest examples of these to me are the ones where there's no reason for it. I don't want people to think that our whole thing is that they're not technically correct about a lot of things, because it's not even that. The whole comedy slapstick bit where somebody slips on a banana peel. You people listening to this in your headphones or in your cars or whatever, raise your hand if you've ever in your life seen someone or heard secondhand slipping and falling on a banana peel that was laying on the floor. That's just not a danger, but you can put in a SpongeBob episode, there's a banana peel on the floor, he slips on it, he's carrying a big stack of plates or something. He's going to slip on that, and 100% of the toddlers will know what that is because they've already seen it in multiple cartoons or whatever growing up. So I actually went to look up where this came from. And there was a Mental Floss article on it because they actually went and laboriously tried to find the origin of it. And apparently, in the middle of the 1800s, it became a really popular street food in New York and in some other cities probably. And there was, in the early 1900s, there was a vaudeville comedian named Billy Watson who claimed he once saw someone slip and almost fall on a banana peel, and then he did this big elaborate slapstick bit where he pretended to slip on a banana peel. So he does that bit in the early 1900s. And long, long, long ago, we've solved the banana peel problem in New York. Like, you lived in New York. Did you see, like, lots of banana peels on the sidewalk?
Only if it was banana season. Then we're all just, the streets are lousy with banana peels. But for the most part, yeah, we've moved beyond that.
Not as popular street food anymore. Now they have actual trash receptacles on the sidewalk. They solved that problem a long, long time ago. But by God, 100 years later, you can play a Mario Kart game. There's a banana peel on the track, and if you drive over it, your car spins out. Because 100 years ago, one comedian in one city saw one person slip on a banana peel, thought it was funny, and built his act around it. And even though probably no one has gone to the emergency room for a banana peel fall in 75 years, to this day, that is a staple of our pop culture. Comedy is supposed to be all about things everybody can identify with. Ah, we've all been there, right? But here's an example where, no, actually none of us have been there. But when we see the joke, we still laugh at it as if it's something like, we all agree this is a hazard. And lots of ideas kind of worm our way into our brain like that. For like 30 straight years, there's a thing in sitcoms where washing machines were just a hazard. They would overflow, right? I don't know if you've seen, like, there's two different Brady Bunch episodes where this happened, where it filled the house with suds because they put too much soap in there or something like that.
Right. I can see that, like a growing blob of suds that just slowly takes over the house and everybody's running around in chaos trying to figure out how to make this stuff.
It happened in Leave It to Beaver. It happened in Freaky Friday. I think both of them, the remake too. It used to be the staple of old sitcoms, and it was always the same plot where either the dad had to use the washing machine or the kids had to use it, but mom was either away or she was laid up. In the Brady Bunch episode, one of them was Alice, the housekeeper, was bedridden. And so, and the joke is always when a man or somebody doesn't know what they're doing tries to handle the washing machine, it's just a disaster. It's going to flood the house. Either soap fills the room to where it's neck deep, or else it just creates a flood for some reason. And there's probably all sorts of messages about the domestic role of women. And like, see what happens? The message of the show was ostensibly, you should appreciate mom for the work she does because it's difficult. Because look what happens when we try to do it. But it also reinforces that only mom can do the laundry. I wonder if when I grew up, because obviously I am old enough to have grown up with the Brady Bunch or whatever, it was a long time before I used the washing machine. I was using the oven long before I was using the washing machine because I was so scared of it. I was scared it would flood the house. And in reality, it's actually really, really hard to do with a washing machine. It's actually hard to destroy your entire home with one. So I guess there's not necessarily any consequences to that other than the fact that, you know, there are lots of kids who grew up scared of the washing machine. But it's just one of those things that I swear there had to have been a whole generation of people that thought that this was just an imminent danger.
Yeah, that we're just terrified of that as a household device. I mean, that's why I still don't wash my own clothes. So you had talked about in one of your past articles the fact that Armani as a brand or Versace as a brand was born in the movie American Gigolo. It was in one of your many articles about male prostitutes. I think you went undercover as one. But one of those really super iconic brands was born in that movie. The costume designer was like, oh, this is a movie set in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is so boring. So they traveled to Italy, and we're like, oh, that we like that designer, and just dressed their American pimp in an Armani suit, and the brand took off. So I had edited an article that covered the movie Wall Street, which apparently everything that you associate with the slick modern Wall Street power broker wearing like expensive Italian suits with slick back hair was totally made up for that movie. They came to the conclusion that if you showed Wall Street as it was, you would just see this kind of sea of gray Brooks Brothers suits, really conservative. And the writer of the movie also spent a bunch of time shadowing these really powerful bankers and came to the conclusion that they were all just really super crazy, boring people. You know, they're guys who are good with numbers and good at managing risk, and they're very conservative. If you go and watch Trading Places, for instance, which came out in 1983, I think that gives you a better idea of how bankers were perceived before Wall Street. Or if you read Bonfire of the Vanities or look at Michael Lewis's book, I think it's called Liar's Poker. They weren't guys who like ride around in glamorous limousines. They come across more as like old money. They're more aristocracy. And there's a undercurrent of racism. And it's just totally different from what we associate modern bankers with, which is kind of the Italian suits. And I remember Gordon Gekko was like the first person to ever appear in a movie with a car phone. Michael Douglas has been quoted in a number of different places talking about how horrified he is by the number of people who come up to him and they're like, yeah, man, Gordon Gekko made me want to be a businessman. He made me want to get into business. And it was basically all started by this movie that was supposed to be a cautionary tale, but nobody wants to see a cautionary tale about a bunch of boring businessmen. They want to sex it up and make it appealing. And so they made the main character seductive. And that became a really acceptable way for smart people to spend their lives, going into these markets that in the past had been viewed as this distasteful thing to do, where you're part of the old money aristocracy.
But not just that, the way they dress, the way they did their hair, they started doing it like Gordon Gekko. That's the thing, is that it starts as fiction, but then the real people going into that field. I think this is the most underestimated part of American society, which is you just assume that it's like, well, you know, real police don't talk like, you know, whatever movie policemen I've seen, but that's not realizing that real police are real people who grew up on those movies. Then right. They go off to the academy and they become police officers, but their expectation of how a police officer talks, behaves, carries himself, the type of, you know, slang he uses, type of jokes he makes, that comes from movies. And so you had, like you said, a generation of traitors who grew up just assuming that whole thing, Gordon Gekko thing, how flamboyant he is, how open he is about the greed stuff, how predatory, and it's all like in your face and spiking the football, and it's all about, you know, how great I am and how great greed is. And it used to not be acceptable to talk like that and to be that guy. But because the movie is portraying the most flashiest version of that and is played by an actor who's incredibly charismatic and, you know, handsome and cool, and, you know, Michael Douglas back in the day, you can't not be attracted to that. This is the same way people have said that, like, there's no such thing as an anti-war movie because war always looks awesome on screen. Even the horrors of war are incredibly exciting to watch on screen. You can't not make it sexy. So when you put anybody under perfect lighting and give them lines to say that are witty and clever and really grab you, you're going to be drawn to it. So you almost can't do a negative portrayal of that guy unless you cast, you know, like Chris Farley in the role, whatever. Like, I'm sure that fighter pilots were always cocky, arrogant types because you would have to, in some degree, be like that to fly a jet. But I don't doubt that in the years after Top Gun, the type of person wanting to go into that and how they saw themselves and how they talked to each other, they have to be channeling Tom Cruise, because how could you not? How could you not want to be that?
I thought you wrote in one of your articles about how the number of people who applied to become naval aviators like shot up after Top Gun. I mean, that's not an insignificant decision. That's not a bunch of people going out and buying straight razors after the last Bond movie, which, by the way, also happened. The sales of straight razors went up 5,000% because there's that sexy scene where the Bond girl shaves him with a straight razor. But that's people choosing what they want to do with their life, and they're being swayed by a movie where a cool dude rides around on a motorcycle and, you know, solves his daddy issues via super fast planes.
Yeah, I think that, I can't remember the number, I think the recruitment went up like 700%, or at least people trying to get in. Like, I'm sure many of them were in no way qualifying. I mean, the same thing with kids taking karate lessons after the Karate Kid, right? It's, you know, I mean, I took karate lessons after Karate Kid. It made karate look so useful.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Because now I just want to learn that if you've seen the movie The Raid, Redemption, I want to learn the martial art they're doing in that movie that involves, like, there's a move where you pick a guy up and smash him through a wall. It, like, kills him in the process, but it's a lot of using knives to stab people to death and things like that. But I don't know where you take the classes.
Yeah, smashing people through walls is the jab of that martial art. That's just the opening parry is throwing someone through a wall. Yeah, another one of my favorite examples of this is the Mafia. Mario Puzo is the novelist who wrote the novel The Godfather that the movie was based on. He made up the term The Godfather. No mafiosa ever referred to the head of their family as The Godfather before that novel came out. And in fact, the people who were fighting organized crime at that time, FBI and local police, were really bummed out when the movie came out because their number one tactic that they were using to fight them was just getting them to rat on each other. And it was super easy because it was a world where, you know, everybody was out for themselves. And so nobody had any problem with, you know, testifying against somebody that they worked with or did a job with. And that movie created this kind of fictional version of the mafia, where everybody is sort of honor bound. There's a great quote from a hitman talking about how his colleagues, they went from guys who said dem and doze instead of them and those until the movie came out, and then they started philosophizing like The Godfather.
If you ask somebody to name the most authentic cop show ever, they'll usually name The Wire, because when you watch it, it just seems more realistic, more gritty, whatever. But you always have to ask yourself, compared to what? What am I comparing it to? You know, a Michael Bay movie, it's a very silly version, but then when you've got something where there's nothing magical happening, the cars don't explode or whatever, all the little things about procedure and all that, you still have to ask yourself, well, like, how closely do they even know what the procedures are, what cop life looks like? And so, for instance, David Simon, the guy behind The Wire, his background, he worked at the Baltimore Sun as a reporter, and so he did a lot of the police beat stuff. So he knew a lot of police, and then when he wrote a book called Homicide: Life on the Killing Street, I think was the title, he spent some time following the homicide detectives in the Baltimore Police Department. But from those few months of dealing with them, he's written many years of cop shows. And very quickly, there's other writers brought on. You're a fiction writer. You're going to write what makes the best fiction, and everything else is going to get sacrificed in service of that. So even if Mario Puzo spent a year traveling with the mob, and I don't think he did, it doesn't matter. When it sits down to write it, you're still writing what looks best on the screen, what comes across cruelest on the screen. What I was saying about the gun reloading earlier, everything is sacrificed in favor of what brings the most drama, what gives the best rhythm to the scene. Again, you're not making a documentary, you're making a fictional story. So for the most part, the writers who sit down to write for a cop show, whether it's CSI, whether it's The Shield or whatever, the dialogue they write and the things the police say to each other, the things they do, that's coming from other cop shows they watched growing up. And then those people were basing it on old crime pulp novels or whatever they had in the decades before that. They're all just repeating the pop culture version of it. And then over time, the real world version starts to conform to the pop culture version.
I did a little soul searching over the weekend because I wanted to find a really stupid one of these that had influenced my behavior. And one thing that I've found myself doing more than once in my life, and I usually catch it pretty quickly because it's really stupid, but if I'm talking to a person who doesn't speak English, I will usually speak English to them louder once I realize that they can't understand what I'm saying, as opposed to using hand gestures, I'll speak to them louder, which is a horrible response. But I think it might be based on this movie trope that I think we've covered on the site before, this idea that if you watch the Ocean's 11 movies, there's that Chinese contortionist who they sneak into the vault who does not speak English, but he understands it. I think we called it in an article like the Lassie approach to people who speak foreign languages, that they can't speak English, but they understand it if you speak it at them loud enough and with enough hand gestures. And the saying the words loudly along with the hand gestures don't get in the way or confuse or frustrate them. They actually help. And I wonder if that's where that instinct comes from in me. If I could rate my worst moments, it would probably be the handful of times when I've spoken loudly at foreign people who didn't speak English.
Not just louder, but slower. Yeah. Like you're saying it loudly and slowly. But again, the problem is that implies that if I simplify it enough, the less human foreigner will. You know, you're not consciously thinking that, but that scene is in the movie. It's always someone being very frustrated, or the hero's desperately trying to get somewhere, but they don't understand what he's saying. So the comedy is from the tension of watching him try to get through to this person, but he's doing it by dumbing down what he's saying. He's being very simplistic, and it doesn't matter if the hero's portrayed as a buffoon. The audience, the white English-speaking audience, is still mentally like, yes, it's awful trying to talk to foreigners. You're right. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, awkward thing, and we should all avoid it. And if only they spoke English, we wouldn't have this problem. The joke that I had been laughing at since I was a child, mainly because it's in, I would say, approximately 40% of all movies, is the whole guy hits on woman at a bar, but it turns out she's a man. Boing.
Right.
That joke, that is ever present. It was in a few weeks ago in the new Michael J. Fox show. It was in The Hangover and the Tone Loc autobiographical track Funky Cold Medina.
The Tone Loc movie Ace Ventura.
Yeah, and The Crying Game. And, but even when they don't show it, they'll reference it as in Aliens. They reference it, and it's always like a joke told like, yeah, he got so drunk he went off with her, but you know, she had an Adam's apple, or he got a surprise. And I didn't know, because I live in my little bubble, didn't know until a year ago how much transgendered people hate that joke because of the implication that they actually intentionally get dressed up in their most girly clothes, go out to bars, intentionally hit on heterosexual males purely to do this, purely to embarrass them, purely to confuse them sexually, purely to make them feel awkward or whatever. And in reality, that's an incredibly dangerous thing for them to do. That's a situation where you can get assaulted, you can get murdered, because males in the real world who go out to bars and they've had a few drinks and they don't react well to this. So that this has become a comedy staple. Ah, you know, 30% of the women in here are secretly dudes. Ha ha. That's such an insulting thing because it implies that they are by nature doing what they do to try to deceive you. And again, the number of times this has actually happened in the real world, I'm going to guess, is incredibly small. The number of times it happens in fiction, it makes it sound like it's happening on an hourly basis. It's just an ever-present danger because it's such a lazy, easy joke. It comes from that place of uncomfortable sexuality or whatever, and that's something we always easily laugh at. But in a world where transgendered people are assaulted at an incredibly high rate and are murdered at a high rate, this is an ever-present danger. You're joking about something that for them would be potentially deadly, but yet that joke will be in the most benign CBS sitcom, you know, Two and a Half Men. It's just an automatic joke and everybody laughs at it, but I didn't realize so very recently how not funny that is to them.
Right. It's the only way that people with ambiguous sexuality show up in TV or movies. That's their only role, is as the person who's using their penis as a prank, basically. The stats on trans people, the life expectancy and likelihood of suicide and homicide is just insane. Really troubling. Makes you very scared for them and very aware of how ridiculous that trope is.
I guess it kind of gets back to the very heart of this, is that when I talk about how pop culture, how it really controls the culture, really controls the way people think, it makes it sound like I'm saying there's an agenda, there's a conspiracy, because everybody thinks their job is more important. You know, I write comedy for a living, so I'm sitting here saying, well, you know who has the real power in this system? Comedy writers. And obviously, you know, my mother used to work at a bank. I'm sure she would tell me, actually, the banks have quite a bit too. But my point is, there is no plan on the part of the people writing this stuff. There's no agenda. Obviously, there's some movies where they're desperately trying to send a message. But for the most part, writers are not making those jokes about transgender or trans women because they want to keep them down or because they want to make life worse for them, right? They're making the joke because it's a joke they heard elsewhere and it made them laugh, and so they repeat it. The power that we as writers have to perpetuate bad attitudes like that is, I can't overstate it, to kind of calcify those ideas and the idea that these people are to be treated a certain way or that they're to not even be thought about, or, you know, the thing with little people or what were called midgets until a few years ago, that it's just hilarious that they're tiny. The idea that there's an actual person having to live with that, and they walk into a room, people just start laughing at them, because in a movie like Mini-Me and Austin Powers, they're little props and they exist to be hilarious to you because they're smaller than what they should be. Every joke sort of perpetuates it, and it's not on purpose. that's not done with any thought either. It's just you go for what makes people laugh. But the ability to kind of keep ideas going, even if they're incorrect, and even if they're inconsistent with what you've seen in your real life, just so you've never seen anybody slip on a banana peel, actually doesn't matter. Because if pop culture tells you this is constantly happening, you'll believe it's constantly happening.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about The Wire and the fact that we assume that everything about it is authentic, but Chuck Klosterman made a really good point on one of his articles, I think, or on a podcast, where he was pointing out how the only season that got ripped apart for being inauthentic was season 5, when David Simon was writing about a world that you would think he would have known because he came from newspapers. That was the season that was about the newspapers, but it seemed inauthentic to writers and bloggers and the sort of people who write about TV shows, because it was kind of a ridiculous plot about a guy who was like making up all these stories. It's once a year some journalist somewhere in America makes up an outlandish story that really tugs at everyone's heartstrings and wins them an award, and it turns out the whole thing was fabricated. And that was the version of the newsroom that he gave people. It wasn't an actual gritty, authentic look at the problems of covering crime in Baltimore and their relationship to the police. It was this kind of fantastical thing that is not a look at the real troubles of covering the news in the inner city. And Klosterman's point was that maybe everything that we've always taken for granted as being authentic about The Wire, the troubles of running an inner city school, the troubles of being a politician and being a cop and being a drug dealer, were just as inauthentic as that. And we just kind of missed that because we have no experience. We were just accepting all that stuff as fact.
One of the many things you would see in any cop show, any cop movie, one of the staples of a crime scene you would expect to see there is when they've drawn the chalk outline around the body or where the body was, or they'll use white tape.
Right. And in a comedy, you know, in Naked Gun and Coming to America, two of my favorite late 80s comedies, there's someone in some hilariously impossible position that suggests that some bizarre murder has taken place.
Yeah, and it's iconic. If you walk into a room and you see a chalk outline of a body there, your question is, who died here? You're not going to be like, well, why does somebody draw on my floor? Everybody recognizes that as marking where the body was. It's not even clear where that came from. They think that back in the olden days of the press, they would photograph crime scene, but they weren't allowed to photograph the body, the corpse, because that was too graphic for the front page. So what they said police used to do was they would move the body but mark where it was so that you could have a visual of this is the crime scene, here's where the guy was lying, but we're not going to show you that, we're going to spare you seeing the guy. But the police wouldn't do that. That's as time went on and actual physical evidence from the scene started to become forensic, started to become a thing, that's totally contaminating the scene, getting down there and drawing around the guy, and there's no reason for it whatsoever. When you see guys at a crime scene drawing circles around things or flagging things, it's things that are difficult to see. Like, hey, there's a cigarette butt over here. You don't want somebody to step on it or kick it. So you draw a circle around it, or they have little flags they can put on it. And it's just so that people don't trample it. This shell casing, same thing. They'll go, you know, circle the shell casings again. Otherwise, somebody's going to come kick them out of the way. But you would never draw a line around the body or draw tape around the body. There's no reason to do it now. There was never a reason to do it. The earliest episode somebody can find, or at least I can, from online, from what I can find, is there was an episode in the 1950s of Perry Mason where the cops had done it. And then again, the producer of that show, whoever set up that scene, got it from who knows where. They saw an old photo and thought it looked cool, or they just assumed that they never picked up the phone and asked the cops if it was authentic. It just seemed like a neat visual flair, and then that was it. It was now a part of the pop culture and a part of what the average person assumes is police procedure, even though no one ever stops to ask, well, why would you need to draw? You have photos of where the body was. Why would you need to draw a crude stick figure of the body lying there? To what purpose does that serve? But you never ask yourself that question because it's just this. It's one of a million things you see that are small and inconsequential, and you have no reason to question them, even if there's also no reason for them to be there.
Yeah, I think the reason probably that it was so useful as a shorthand was the same reason that it started out. Like you said, the newspaper couldn't show these criminals with their heads half blown off laying in the street, or at least some newspapers didn't want to show that. And so they used this as a way to sort of signify that that had happened. And same with TV shows, right? Perry Mason can't show an actual person who has bullet holes in them. So they just kind of used what they'd seen in the newspapers. That's what I found too, that it's only used to mark small pieces of evidence that somebody might miss. And even then, it's just like a little disposable tag. They'll use a post-it note because that can't be contaminated. They'll open up a fresh pack of post-it notes and use that and then discard it. But never with the body, right? Because the body is going to be pretty impossible to miss. It's not the piece of evidence that you're going to accidentally trip over.
Yeah, that would be a really terrible Mr. Magoo-style cop who stumble onto the crime scene and not realize that.
Unless there's a banana peel there, possibly. You have to watch out for that.
But if I had to leave everybody with a final thought to keep in mind, when you're watching anything, anything is fictional, it would be this. You know how in every cop TV show, the cop is a little bit of a loose cannon. He doesn't really play by the rules. He kind of writes his own rules. Okay, the primary reason for that, obviously it's more fun to watch a loose cannon, but the primary reason why Dr. House is a doctor who plays by his own rules and doesn't go by the book, is it saves the writer the trouble of having to look up the book.
Right.
Because if he's not following the rules of procedure, the actual rules of evidence, if he's violating the witness's rights, you can always, always, always write it off as, well, yeah, but he writes his own rule. This is Vic Mackey. This is Dirty Harry. This is a Jack Bauer. Jack Bauer doesn't following the federal government's rules for anti-terror. He's writing his own rules, damn it. In other words, you skew your writing that way because it makes it easier. And I don't want to say the writers are lazy, but they are under a lot of time pressure, and almost every choice you make is kind of made with that in mind. I have a scene that's set in Egypt. I do not have a month to study Egypt to make sure this is authentic. I'm writing Transformers 5, and they've given me 1 week to write it.
Right.
We turn that on Friday. So if they're going to go to Egypt, yes, they're going to be on the freaking Great Pyramid, and it's going to look exactly like it looked in the last cartoon you saw or action movie you saw or photo you remember seeing in an encyclopedia. And you're not going to mention that in reality there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken right next to the Great Pyramid or a block away from it because it's a huge tourist trap. And
yeah, it's like right in the city. It's almost like the way that Central Park, you can see a bunch of buildings from the middle of Central Park, and you can see the middle of Central Park from a bunch of buildings. Many of the pyramids are just right there, right in the city, just a little bit off in the distance. But yeah, like you said, and it's not just that the writer doesn't have the time to do the research and go to the pyramids. It's that the movie doesn't have the time to establish, oh, everything you've heard is wrong. They're working with our limited attention span, and the thing that they're trying to establish is that these giant robots are having this climactic battle. They're not trying to teach us a lesson about Egypt.
Right. If those robots get tackled off the pyramid and crash into the Kentucky Fried Chicken, the viewer thinks that's a hilarious mistake.
Right, exactly.
Like, oh my God, Michael Bay thinks there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken there. It has to conform with the same stupid things. And the same thing if you've got a movie where the character's best friend is a trans woman. By God, every line of dialogue has to be about that. That person can't just exist as a human being because the audience is too distracted by it. Everything has to revolve around the fact that this is a transgendered person, and they have to constantly be talking about it, constantly be joking about it. It's got to be hilarious that it's, you know, oh, it's a man dressed as a woman or vice versa or whatever. And so those limitations, those little lazy sort of shortcuts, utterly dominate almost everything you read and watch. And the more you can keep that in mind, the better, because it's not, for the most part, there to necessarily make you smarter or to broaden your horizons. It's much, much easier and much faster to kind of appeal to what you already think and what you already think you know.
Right.
And just lots of times it's horribly, horribly wrong.
Right. Because at that point, your job is not to tell the truth. You shouldn't be researching what Egypt actually looks like. Your job is to go find out the picture that most movies have painted of Egypt. Writers are sort of beholden to set every single movie inside this parallel version of reality where everything takes its most iconic form. Mafia guys are going to talk like Marlon Brando because that's what the readers expect, unless your movie is about the fact that mafia guys don't talk like Marlon Brando.
There is a certain way that iconography works, and the way it was always described to me is that in a cartoon, if a character picks up a banana, you immediately recognize it. It's yellow, it's curved. If he picks up a green banana, even though green bananas exist in real life, you don't know what he's got in his hand because it's just you haven't seen it like that in a cartoon. And so there are certain things where they have to look a certain way and people have to talk a certain way and behave a certain way or else you'll have that moment of confusion. The movie is the same thing. People have to act the way you expect them to act, expect them to behave, or else the audience is distracted by it. Well, how is this trans person just living their life without constantly talking about the fact that they have male and female genitalia? How is this possible? Because it's so hard to get around the audience's own stereotypes and preconceived notions and all that, it's just so much easier to play within them. Whether it's something really innocuous or something really ugly, it's just always easier. And it's always easier to simplify rather than make it more complicated.
That boy needs therapy.
Psychosomatic.
That boy needs therapy.
Purely psychosomatic.
That boy needs therapy.
Lying down on the couch?
What does that mean?
All right, that was our conversation. I think it's important to note here that there's nothing that says movies have to perpetuate the same old boring stereotypes. And for instance, the movie Gravity did the opposite of this. It took the version of space that was painted inside our head by years of sci-fi movies where it's just space planes zipping around the night sky, and it replaced it with a reality that was way more interesting. But that is what that entire movie was about. From the opening line that was written on the black screen about how hard space wants to kill you to the very end, it was all about space doesn't work like Star Trek and Star Wars told you it did. And I guess those are your two options when you're creating a movie. You either make a movie that exists inside the same fictional universe as every other movie in your genre, or you spend your entire movie kind of breaking the rules and explaining the new rules and building a world where the rules are different. And so that's why I think Gravity gives us hope, because, you know, it might start a new trend in movies that challenge some of the assumptions that we've been seeing for years. All right, footnotes. You heard Nasty by Nas from 2011, which was just an awesome return to form after a period of kind of, I think he was just bored and listless for a while. But it was really important for me that we include some rap song that refers to Al Pacino and his movies, because Al Pacino movies created the moral universe of rap culture. I think he refers to Carlito's Way in there. And then we heard Frontier Psychiatrist from The Avalanches off their album Since I Left You. They're an Australian outfit. Suddenly I've turned into Dick Clark here. Came out in 2000 and they've been working on the follow-up ever since. That's how good the album is. It's a lot of pressure. If you liked that song, the title track Since I Left You, also pretty great. And I chose The Avalanches for this episode because, first of all, it's just a great song that I'm excited to be sharing with any of you young folks who weren't aware of its existence, but also because they make their music purely from samples. The album overall uses 3,500 different records, and it blends them all into a new one, which felt appropriate for how movies create our sense of reality by combining and recombining each other's bullshit. I don't know if that was convincing. I think I just really like the song Frontier Psychiatrist. All right, you can check out those songs on our Spotify playlist, Cracked Podcast Music, uploaded by Cracked Podcast. And you can buy our book, The D-Textbook, The D-E-Textbook, all one word, on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble's or just wherever people still sell books. It's really good. It's not all about ostriches. That was just one of thousands of mind-blowing true stories behind myths that you learned growing up.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. We would totally appreciate it if you rated us on iTunes. And yeah, we'll be back next week with another conversation, I think with Jason again, about why Christmas movies are secretly propaganda. Talk to you then.
That boy needs therapy.
You're psychosomatic.
That boy needs therapy.
Lying down on the couch.
What does that mean?
You're a nut. You're crazy in the coconut.
What does that mean?
That boy needs therapy.
I'm gonna kill you.
That boy needs therapy.
Granny Gazoo, let's have it, you. Now when I count three.
That boy needs therapy.
He was white as a sheep.
And he also made false teeth.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.